curling moments that brings you out in a cold sweat whenever you remember them, and which you can never repeat to anyone, ever, not even your best friend. It was interesting to see how many of us, out of a group of about 25 people of diverse ages, were passionately painting their stones red. We were then invited to take our stones, put them on a cairn, and walk away from them, leaving them, as it were, behind us. If only it were that simple. We can project them onto inanimate objects and try to get rid of them that way. We can bury them in the back of our minds and think we've forgotten them. We can replay them endlessly to ourselves in the hope that by so doing we will draw their sting. On the days when we're feeling particularly mature, we can even laugh at ourselves and put it all down to experience. The truth is, our worst moments have a terrible tendency to spring on us unawares, to turn up uninvited when we least want to see them. They don't go away. And, of course, they are most likely to reappear when we find ourselves in a similar situation, facing similar choices, confronting similar challenges to the one that got us into trouble in the first place. Here they come, our sleeping demons, to rattle our cages, fatally undermine our confidence, and make us mistrust our judgment, so that we just want to run for cover, play it safe, and not expose ourselves in that way ever again. I suppose it's not surprising that this should be the way of it, because our worst moments mostly happen in situations in which we've invested a huge amount, a lot of work, a lot of hope, a lot of nervous energy, even a lot of prayer. The stakes are high, so the disaster potential is also high, and these are situations which really matter to us. Our identity is tied up in them. Whether it's the professional gamble which goes spectacularly wrong, or the really good degree which everyone expected and which somehow turned into an embarrassing third. The performance where no one understood the concept, or nobody laughed at the jokes, or where you died in midline or midnote. Or the public meeting where you called in every favour you were ever owed to get the First Minister along to speak, and 17 people turned up. Or 200 people turned up and the First Minister didn't. Or whether it's the almost limitless possibilities for humiliation contained in the messy and dangerously enticing business of relationships and sexuality. In all of these, we have a lot to lose. This is the stuff of nightmare. And the worst thing is that even when it's over, it's not over. It makes us more cautious, less likely to take risks, more inhibited about reaching high, or perhaps about diving deep. We hear the lesson that the odds are not good. For every shell that contains a pearl, there are 99 that contain nothing but grit. Of course, not all of that grit is made up of our worst moments. Nothing like all, which is just as well, otherwise we'd never even get out of bed in the morning. There are a lot of other things in the grit too. There's our spiritual life, for example. Our attempts to be moral, to live a good life, to have a satisfying prayer life, to find a good church, to do the right thing. I belong to a community which has as part of its rule a commitment to praying daily for all its other members and praying for the peace of the world. I wish I could stand here and tell you that I think that doing this has made me a better person. or that my prayer life carries me through the day in an uplifted state, or that I feel closer to God because of it. But I don't. The world is not noticeably more peaceful. And I have observed that the days when I do feel slightly more lifted up because of it, more harmonious, more cooperative, more capable of rising to the heights, are precisely the ones when I'm most likely to turn round in an instant and become quarrelsome, fractious, and down in the dumps. It's a transition we know only too well. That thing where it's just when we're feeling particularly elevated and particularly holy, in an instant we turn and snarl most viciously at the children for making a noise. It's like a kind of mini speeded up fall from heaven to hell in 60 seconds. Sometimes I forget to pray at all. Margaret. It's the same thing with worship. In the Abbey on Iona, we have services every day, and for many people who come to stay for a week, the worship can be a highlight of their visit. But if you live there for several years and it's part of your daily life, the number of times you just go into the Abbey because your feet carry you, and you go through the morning service in which the words have ceased to make sense because you've said them so many times, it's considerable. And even for people there on a short visit, it's remarkable how many faults there are to be found. This chorus is sexist and militaristic. That song is all about political correctness. There's too much teaching of new songs. Why are we singing these dull old hymns? This isn't worship, it's a pantomime. These services are much too wordy. This worship is off-puttingly evangelical. This worship is like the liberal intelligentsia at prayer. And all of that was only last week. People looking for pearls and finding grit. Christian community also attracts many seekers after pearls. People looking for the intimacy and sharing, the support and challenge, the peace and tranquility they expect to find in a Christian community on a remote Hebridean island. They are often disappointed. The German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote that Christian community was not about finding any of these things, that it was a rare privilege if you did find them, and that Christian community was instead about doing God's will. And he also wrote that people have to die to their vision of the ideal community. Let go of their blueprint of community in order to find the one that's actually there. But still, it's hard to give up everything for the sake of the pearl and find you've got a shell full of grit. The notion that the pearl lies in perfection, or at least perfectibility, is a rather ambiguous one. One of my favourite writers is the Scottish writer Robert Louis Stevenson, who wrote those well-loved classics, Treasure Island and Kidnapped, and rather more darkly, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. One of his less-known works is called A Christmas Sermon, and in it, he challenges some of our ideas about perfection. In rather Victorian language, but surprisingly contemporary tone for someone writing over 100 years ago, he says this about idealism, for example. The idealism of serious people in this age of ours is of a noble character. It never seems to them that they have served enough. They have a fine impatience of their virtues. It were perhaps more modest to be singly thankful that we are no worse. To ask to see some fruit of our endeavour but a transcendental way of serving for reward, and what we take for contempt of self is only greed of hire. Noble disappointment, noble self-denial are not to be admired, nor even to be pardoned if they bring bitterness. It is one thing to enter the kingdom of heaven maimed, another to maim yourself and stay outside. And the kingdom of heaven is of the childlike, those who are easy to please, who love and who give pleasure. And he says this about sin. It is probable that nearly all who think of conduct at all think of it too much. It's certain that we all think too much of sin. We are not damned for doing wrong, but for not doing right. Christ would never hear of negative morality. Thou shalt was ever his word, with which he superseded thou shalt not. To make our idea of morality center on forbidden acts is to defile the imagination and to introduce into our judgments of our fellow men a secret element of gusto. If a thing is wrong for us, we should not dwell upon the thought of it, or we shall soon dwell upon it with inverted pleasure. A man may have a flaw, a weakness that unfits him for the duties of life, that spoils his temper, that threatens his integrity, or that betrays him into cruelty. It has to be conquered, but it must never be suffered to engross his thoughts. The true duties lie all upon the farther side and must be attended to with a whole mind so soon as this preliminary clearing of the decks has been effected. In order that he may be kind and honest, it may be needful that he should become a total abstainer. Let him become so then, and the next day let him forget the circumstance. Trying to be kind and honest will require all of his thoughts. And he warns against the kind of virtue that slips so easily into judgmentalism. A strange temptation attends upon man to keep his eye on pleasures, even when he will not share them. The sight of a pleasure in which we cannot or else will not share moves us to a particular impatience. It may be because we are envious, or because we are sad, or because we dislike noise and romping, being so refined, or because, being so philosophic, we have an overweighing sense of life's gravity. At least as we go on in years, we are all tempted to frown upon our neighbour's pleasures. People are nowadays so fond of resisting temptation. Here is one that should be resisted. developing into new harmonic wholes. So to keep life alive in complexity and complicity with all of being, there is only poetry. How, out of all the chances and changes, to select the features of real significance? I guess that's another way of saying that finding the pearl involves deciding what is most valuable to us, most precious, of most significance. That's to say, where is our treasure? Or as Jesus expressed it, where is our true life? When we are small children, the world is full of desirable things and we want to have them all, think we can. As we grow up, we learn sooner or later that we must choose, make decisions, and that is hard and often painful. It means making priorities, evaluating, weighing up alternatives, and yet it is a necessary part of maturity. Not to decide is also to decide. But I think this process of discernment has been somewhat muddied for us by an economic system and its underlying spirituality, which delays maturity by seeking to convince us that actually we can have it all. That no longer do we have to make choices and set priorities, because now we have a marketplace which will provide us with all our heart's desires. Or at least, if it can't actually manufacture the perfect lover or the ideal family for us, will certainly sell us all that we need to set us on the way. The clothes, the perfume, the car, the furniture, the lifestyle, the Italian spaghetti sauce. And if that isn't enough to do it for us, then it will provide the services for our self-improvement, because we must be culpable if these things don't work. The gym, the personal trainer, the life coach, the cosmetic surgery, the house doctor, the garden designer. And then it will loan us the money to do all of these things, because there will never be enough to compensate for our inadequacies, and we will be in debt for the rest of our lives. We know that is arrant nonsense. Of course we do. But it is enormously seductive arrant nonsense. And there are few of us who can completely resist the commodification of our lives. Our market economy operates on the basis of encouraging us to live in illusion, to blur the lines between our needs and our wants till we can barely tell the difference, and anyone can sell us anything, including a whole lot of stuff we don't need and barely knew we wanted. The fact is, we can't have it all, and it's a terrible lie to tell people that they can. For example, people who come to Greenbelt are probably much too smart and sophisticated to fall for all that lifestyle stuff, right? But I guess that a lot of you marched to oppose the war on Iraq. That's great. The Iona community has a justice and peace commitment. We marched too. But if we're really serious about being opposed to war, and not just to wars that might upset our peace and quiet, then we also need to be seriously opposed to the arms trade, especially our own heavily subsidised British arms trade. This is one area in which Britain is a world leader. Every year, 500,000 people across the world are killed by guns, which can be bought in some places for the price of a chicken. It's estimated that there are some 100 million guns circulating in Africa alone. It makes Iraq look like a Sunday school picnic. The worst impact is borne by innocent civilians, children, the sick and elderly. Bullets claim more lives in Africa than such major killers as tuberculosis, malaria, or road accidents. Firearms have transformed stable and relatively prosperous communities into medieval fiefdoms. Vast areas of countryside are abandoned as millions flee their homes in terror. Schools close, hospitals shut, ordinary life grinds to a standstill. Economic and social development has been stripped away. There are huge profits in selling guns. There's no such thing as a poor arms dealer, but the most vulnerable pay a high price. It was hoped that a new arms export control bill would end such irresponsible deals in Britain. But Tony Blair gave the bill a green light. The House of Lords tried to strengthen the law, but the government has diluted it again. Opposing the arms trade, however, also means thinking about where our investments go. We may not have shares, but our banks do, our insurance companies do, our pension providers do, and a lot of them invest in arms manufacturing. If you want to oppose war, but also have a quiet life, forget it. You can't have them both. Or perhaps you just want to head for the hills. Go down to the sea, get back to the land and enjoy the beauty of nature. And you probably can. But if you want your children's children to be able to do the same thing, then you probably shouldn't be driving a car. I'm not trying to beat anyone up here. I'm just trying to say that we can't have everything. If we want to have a clear conscience, we have to be active dissenters from the globalised market economy, because God knows our present patterns of trade are killing a lot of people. Even then, it's pretty difficult to have a clear conscience. When Jesus told his story about how the kingdom of God was like a precious pearl, it was in the context of a much longer discourse in which he challenged his listeners to think about their own values, their own true life, and particularly he challenged them on the subject of wealth and poverty. His listeners were mostly poor people, and like people in all times and places, probably they had something of a belief that if only they were rich, then their lives would be better, more secure, more full, less anxious. But Jesus is having none of it. No, he says, you don't need any excess, just enough for today. Don't stockpile, don't store up. Today, this moment, is all you know you have. The rest is in the hands of God. Your surpluses will profit you nothing. A little later, he tells them to sell all their belongings and give the money to the poor. Jesus makes a corporate response to need. Rather than the individual accumulation of wealth as an insurance, he suggests instead a sharing community in which each will have enough for the day. Jesus' love of and concern for those who are poor is so well documented that I need not dwell on it here. Less often repeated are his warnings to the rich, whom he also loved, of the dangers inherent in their wealth. Underlying all of this in a commodified world is the moral desensitization that occurs as the gap between rich and poor becomes ever greater. The inability to discern what is actually enough in a world in which both in terms of economics and the environment there is enough for everyone's need, but not for everyone's greed. The ethical obscenity of conspicuous overconsumption when so many suffer poverty and want. The spiritual alienation from a human community in which if one part suffers, all the other parts suffer with it. And the consequent loss of belonging to a human community in which if one part rejoices, all the other parts can rejoice with it. Jesus says again and but in what we value and in how we attend to what we value. Our society has undergone a huge shift, accelerated in recent years, from defining our work in particular, but other aspects of life too, in terms of cultural value, to defining them in terms of economic value. Everything has its price. It's often quoted, and we have had to learn to put a price on our skills, our experience, our time, to market ourselves. Values are about deciding what's most important to us. It's about deciding the worth of things and about setting priorities. Money and time are the two currencies that people use most in our society. These are what we spend. Time is money, we say. And we calculate our earnings by time. The Island community requires its members to account to one another for how we spend our money and our time. Because this way, we can get a real insight into what our core values really are, rather than what we think, say, or hope they are. Because above all, our values show up in what we do. It's where we put our theories into practice, where we practice what we preach. It's where we put our money where our mouths are. When social inclusion nowadays depends on the economic, we are what we spend, and if we can't spend, you're excluded. It's vital that people are not also excluded politically and culturally. Perhaps the starkest statements of exclusion come in the consistent experience of people living in poverty in this country, that being poor results in being regarded and treated with disrespect. Stigma, patronage, even criminalisation are commonplace experiences for people living in poverty. Along with that goes isolation. Poverty is an isolating experience in Britain, and being poor in a poor community does not necessarily guarantee solidarity. People take care of what they value. If you want to know what someone really values, look at what they take care of. And people also assess their own value and worth by the care they see being taken with and about them. Love is not concerned with whom you pray or where you slept the night you ran away from home. Love is concerned that the beating of your heart should kill no one. These are big issues, big challenges, and they feel pretty gritty to me. But maybe that's the way it's meant to be. When I look at my life, it seems full of grit, full of failures and ambiguity and partial achievements and excruciating moments and uncomfortable complicity with systems I hate and sorrow for all the things I can't change. And that God I only catch occasional glimpses of when I'm not looking or when I'm looking for something else. But I don't experience it that way. It just feels like my life, and it's also full of love and laughter and things that, if I'm honest, feel like pearls. They just don't seem to fit any of the accepted categories for what a pearl is. They feel like gifts, things that just showed up. I didn't have to dive for them, and I didn't have to sell everything I possessed to get them. But if there is anything that I would describe as my true life, my treasure, it is the increasing capacity for gratitude, to appreciate, to take delight in quite small and ordinary things. Natural pearl is formed in shellfish as a reaction to an irritant, like a piece of grit. So perhaps it's been the case that I really need all that grit in my life, because without it, there would be no pearls. Perhaps that's what Robert Louis Stevenson is getting at in this poem, which he called The Celestial Surgeon. If I have faltered more or less in my great task of happiness, if if I have moved among my race and shown no glorious morning face, if beams from happy human eyes have moved me not, if morning skies, books, and my food and summer rain knocked on my sullen heart in vain, Lord, thy most pointed pleasure take and stab my spirit broad awake. Or, Lord, if too obdurate I, choose thou before that spirit die, a piercing pain, a killing sin, and to my dead heart run them in. Anyway, perhaps I'm also finding the pearl in learning to love the 99 shells full of grit. We alone can devalue gold by not caring if it falls or rises in the marketplace. Wherever there is gold, there is a chain, you know, and if your chain is gold, so much the worse for you. Feathers, shells, and C-shaped stones are all as rare. This could be our revolution, to love what is plentiful as much as what's scarce.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kathy Galloway.